The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
The Lunchtime Doctor Special Edition today as we celebrate Endometriosis Awareness Month. So we say good afternoon to Dr. Brittany Dean.
Hi, good afternoon, Bass, and it is lovely to be here again. And of course, we touched on endometriosis earlier this month, but today we have a very special guest. We have Dr. Vishal Bahal with us today, and he is an obstetrician and gynecologist. So we are going to go into more detail about endometriosis for Endometriosis Awareness Month. Now, Dr. Bahal completed his medical training at the University of the West Indies, St. Augustine, and subsequently completed his residency training in obstetrics and gynecology with a postgraduate degree from the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Dr. Bahal further subspecialized with a fellowship in gynecological oncology at Belfast City Hospital, Northern Ireland. He is also an accredited colposcopist from the British Society of Colposcopy and Cervical Pathology. Dr. Bahal is very keen on research with over 20 peer-reviewed publications. He also has a passion for improving minimally invasive surgery in gynecology and gyne-oncology, with having hosted 4 surgical courses in Trinidad and Guyana. He currently offers his clinical expertise in both Gulfview Medical and various RHAs while providing administrative services as head of department in obstetrics and gynecology at San Fernando General Hospital and as the National Cervical Cancer Lead in Ministry of Health, Trinidad and Tobago. Well, that's a mouthful.
Hi, so, nice.
Good afternoon, Dr. Bahal.
Hi, afternoon.
And it's a pleasure to have you here today. We're going to be talking about endometriosis. And of course, during the course of this entire session, we will encourage all our listeners to call in, send your WhatsApps, and ask any questions. Today, we're celebrating Endometriosis Awareness Month. So we're just going to kick off the segment by talking about what is endometriosis.
Okay, thanks a lot for having me, and thanks for the introduction. So endometriosis is a condition where women have the presence of endometrial cells outside of the endometrial lining. Now, when we say outside the endometrial lining, this can be anywhere, literally anywhere in the body. Now, frequently, we see it in certain sites in a woman's body. The most common sites would be within the muscle of the womb. Mm-hmm. It can be behind the womb. It can be on the ovaries. It can also be present on other structures like in the bowel. Mm-hmm. I've had patients who had rarer presentations where it was present within the umbilicus. It was present in the ureter. That's a tube that transports urine from the kidney to the bladder. Mm-hmm. It is also, I have had patients with endometriosis within breast tissue as well as in the lung. So it presents a wide array. Now, these rarer presentations, some of them are less than 1% of patients, but the more common sites, about 1 in 10 women would have these, be affected with endometriosis at these various sites.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us, what is the underlying cause, or what actually causes this endometrial tissue to end up in places outside of the uterine cavity?
So that's an excellent question. So endometriosis, there are different schools of thought with regards to this etiology and what we call the underlying cause. So I'll start off first. There is a condition where we call retrograde menstruation. Mm-hmm. Basically, when a woman has a period, some of these same endometrial cells go through the tubes and end up in the abdominal cavity. Mm-hmm. And they attach to different structures within the abdominal cavity, and namely the pelvis. But that mechanism alone can't entirely explain why someone would have endometriosis in their breast tissue, in their lung. Now, I want to also mention another mechanism where when these same cells go through the tube and are in the pelvis, you have to remember, in any person's body, When the heart pumps blood, you have this blood going down the left side of someone's body, then mm-hmm. blood drains, goes back up to the heart on the right side. So inadvertently in the tummy, there is a circulation of fluid that goes in this clockwise, I believe that's clockwise, mm-hmm. in this direction. So sometimes when you have this retrograde menstruation going into the pelvis, those same cells seed in mm-hmm. that direction, and that can explain why sometimes you have endometriosis present in the right side, sometimes going up on the right side of the lung as opposed to the left side.
Yes.
And that's, those are the mechanisms.
Yes. So the research is not actually fully understood.
Correct.
Because I know in research that I've done, like they've mentioned, you know, the lymphatic tissue, the lymphatic
Correct.
System as well.
Exactly.
And it's just a mechanism that's not fully understood. So since we're talking about this, are there any risk factors that our listeners should know about for endometriosis?
So the biggest risk factor from my practice as well is genetics.
Mm-hmm.
I have patients who I treat. I would treat one patient. Her sister would have it. Her mom would have it.
Mm-hmm.
So we know there is a strong family history of this endometriosis. Sometimes there are other medical conditions when people have adenomyosis. When people have adenomyosis, that's where you have endometriosis tissue mm-hmm. within the muscle. So sometimes other, or if a woman has a condition where that causes her to have her period, go through the tubes. So if you have blockage of the uterus in some form or fashion, that can increase your risk of retrograde menstruation. That, by and large, can also increase your risk of getting endometriosis tissue outside, and as a result, symptoms of such.
Okay, all right, no problem. So you're talking about if a girl sees her period earlier, and what if a woman sees menopause later? Would that give them more of a chances of getting endometriosis because of this chance of retrograde menstruation occurring?
So I believe it's a two-factor mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned earlier menstruation, mm-hmm. late menopause. So that in itself could increase the number of periods
yes.
a woman has.
Mm-hmm.
If theoretically you increase the number of periods a woman has, by and large, you will increase her chance of having endometriosis tissue outside of
yes.
the womb by that respect. But you also have, I mean, we have a lot of patients who have early menses, late menopause, or even if they have less of that, you have to have this other mechanism, which I believe is a genetic predisposition.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So you have this two-hit mechanism where you have early menses,
yes.
late menopause, together with this predisposition in order to develop the symptoms of endometriosis.
Right. And now you're talking about the symptoms. So tell our listeners what they would expect if they do have endometriosis, or what symptoms are very common.
Sure. So the most common symptom a woman presents in my office, or presents to a doctor gynecologist, would be painful periods.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times people say they have painful periods, and it's out of the norm to the extent where they have to take painkillers or even miss work. So it basically, you're talking about affecting someone's life.
Mm-hmm.
Other symptoms would be heavy periods. You can have symptoms where you have painful intercourse, and then when you now compare what I was explaining before, where endometriosis can be present, they can present with symptoms of that. For example, I've had patients who had bleeding from the belly button. That's when you have endometriosis in the belly button. I've had patients with GI symptoms. What I mean by that is constipation, diarrhea, bloating, those sort of symptoms. Now, how do you differentiate those other symptoms from something else? And why am I saying it could be endometriosis? Well, the main thing we look for, it's cyclical.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody says they have bloating, but doc, entering my period, it actually gets better. Or doc, I have passage, but you know what? It hasn't. It is not related to my period. I then think, well, this may not be anything to do with endometriosis. This can be another issue altogether. So the symptoms of endometriosis, essentially, it's cyclical. So it gets worse with your period, and it progresses to a point where someone says, doc, I have this discomfort, I have these symptoms all the time, but you know what? It gets worse with my period. That, for me, is an indicator that, look, we could be dealing with endometriosis.
Okay. All right. No problem. And how is endometriosis diagnosed? So how would you diagnose it in your office?
Right. So a lot of times, endometriosis, the gold standard, I'll start off by saying, is is by doing what you call a laparoscopy. That's where you put in a camera to look inside the tummy. Mm-hmm. But to be honest, you know, from a practical standpoint, if I have a, you know, a 25-year-old who has painful periods and I'm thinking it's endometriosis, I'm not going to say, here, well, let's put in a lap, let's put in a scope and mm-hmm. let's do a surgery just for us to know that, that you have that. Sometimes we start off some of the initial treatment mechanisms, which we'll get to, mm-hmm. And then if those symptoms improve, I say, well, it's likely you have endo, because we sort of reserve the surgery or that much more invasive process for a woman who has a condition that needs treated for, and which we'll get to. So gold standard is laparoscopy to diagnose, but a lot of times we don't always jump to that as an initial as initial method of diagnosis. Another investigation I want to mention would be an MRI scan and ultrasounds. So we usually start off with an ultrasound, and if an ultrasound is normal, which it is in majority of times, because you can diagnose ultrasound, we then move on to the simple treatment options or even doing an MRI scan rather than jumping to surgery to diagnose.
Yes, because surgery might be a little too invasive in the first, you know.
First instance, yes. Yeah, and it's costly as well.
Exactly. Yeah. So now that you mentioned, you know, you're going to start the treatment, etc., how is it treated?
So we start off with simple treatment measures. So I'll just go step by step. Mm-hmm. Initially, if I have a young person and they say, doc, well, you know what, my only symptom is just some mild pains, that's about it. Sometimes we use simple analgesics because mm-hmm. patients may not want anything more. They just want a reason and they want to know, look, it's nothing more serious, or they want to make sure it's nothing cancerous. And so initially we use simple analgesics. We then move on to using the oral contraceptive pill. Mm-hmm. Now that is usually first line in a lot of patients. We start off by using this cyclical. So you would hear this word cyclical. So essentially, let's use an example of a pill which has 21 pills. Mm-hmm. 21 pills mean we use it for 21 days, we take a 1 week break, and you go another 21 days and you use the pill like that. Mm-hmm. A lot of patients experience significant relief with that, and we recommend they continue it. Now, in some patients, they would say, doc, I have some improvement. However, it hasn't gotten there yet. They're still having that significant, you know, discomfort. I then will then move on to trying the same pill, but continuous. So instead, I would use the pill for 2 or 3 months at a time with no break. And a lot of times I have patients who are controlled very well mm-hmm. on this, you know, this method or this treatment. So they will continue it for 2 months, have a break, then another 2 months, and they're happy with that, with no other issues. Mm-hmm. Now, if this doesn't work, we have other methods. Or if this method isn't suitable for that patient. For example, I have patients who suffer with migraines. Mm-hmm. They may be a smoker. They may be have other medical conditions like they're diabetic, hypertensive, and they can't use the pill. For those patients, we can use other methods like the Depo-Provera. Mm-hmm. So it's a progesterone-type hormone, and they get that every 3 months. That will provide some relief, but again, we tailor that to the particular patient.
Yes.
And that's an injection. Some people in our culture, they say, doc, I don't want any injection. They prefer a pill. So you have to be aware of, you know, which treatment option is right for your patient. Mm-hmm. We have other options moving on from that now. We have something called the Myrina. Mm-hmm. It's a levonorgestrel intrauterine system. Essentially, simply put, it's another type of progesterone hormone. Mm-hmm. Now, this is put in the womb.
Yes.
So for patients who said, doc, I can't take a pill every day. Mm-hmm. I don't want an injection. Yes. This is a good option. Mm-hmm. But again, there are some patients who would choose this first off because their symptom might be painful and heavy periods and nothing else. And they may also want some form of long-acting contraception.
Yes.
So this is excellent for those patients. You put this in, it stays in for 5 years, and it can come out anytime before, and it treats those symptoms pretty well. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of patients who have this fear of the IUD, or yes, intrauterine device. They say, doc, I don't want that inside me. I feel like I don't want anything inside me. They have this, you know, fear of that. Or they also say, doc, if you put this in me, suppose it reach somewhere else in my tummy. Mm-hmm. But the risk of those things happening is very, very low,
yes,
less than 1%. So I have a lot of patients who I put it in and they're very happy with it. Mm-hmm. And they don't have to worry about taking a pill, you know, taking an injection, nothing like that.
So I hear that you're talking a lot about contraceptives being a management for endometriosis. This is just a question of mine.
Sure.
What about the implant that is inserted in the hand? Can that also be used as a form of management?
Good question. Excellent. So yes, it can be because of the type of hormone that's used. Mm-hmm. And when you put this in, this systemic hormone does treat or help treat the endometriosis. And that is one form of treatment.
Yes.
That is available in all public facilities in Trinidad and Tobago. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to get that done, meaning you get a referral into the health center or to any gynecology clinic. Mm-hmm. And you can have that done within a month.
Yes.
So there's no, the waiting time isn't very long at all. The downside with every treatment option, there's always a side effect or a risk. So and from my practice or my experience dealing with patients, they tend to shy away from having something invasive in their arm, yes, like that mm-hmm. something put in. They look at it as a minor procedure. But I have to say it is common a certain population or certain types of patients who say, look, they don't want anything in the womb. They would be happy with that. So I always mention it to all patients.
Yes.
And so that way they choose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you have to mention side effects of each.
Exactly. And, well, we're talking about non-surgical methods,
yes,
of intervention here. But when we get to patients who are older, patients who have had kids, are there any surgical interventions that can actually treat endometriosis in these patients?
Right. So it's important to be aware of as well. Endometriosis affects women in their fertility years.
Yes.
Because that's when your ovaries are active. So it's important to know that, and I always kind of use this analogy to patients, the two times in a woman's life where endometriosis kind of gets better, mm-hmm, is when you're pregnant,
yes,
and when you go through menopause.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the medications sort of simulate those conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get older, when you're closing in on, let's say, for example, if you're more than 45,
mm-hmm,
and you're heading up to 50, you know your ovaries are slowly decreasing in function.
Mm-hmm.
And these patients tend to have these symptoms of endo get a little better.
Yes.
So unless you have something surgical that, mm-hmm, needs to be removed,
mm-hmm,
and I'll mention some of those in a bit, unless you have a large ovarian cyst or something surgical that needs to have done, you tend to... So I'm talking about a patient that has nothing to find on an ultrasound, MRI, but they just have symptoms. You find that those get better as they get more than 45, and some of these same medical options work,
right,
like the Myrina, the implant. However, if you have something that needs surgical removal, I will give you some examples. Sometimes I have a woman who would have adenomyosis.
Yes.
That's where you have endometrial tissue within the muscle.
Mm-hmm.
They have heavy, really painful periods. You try all the medical options. You will then move on to things like a hysterectomy.
Mm-hmm.
If you have someone who has an ovarian cyst related to endometriosis, mm-hmm, and what we call an endometrioma, you will, if people look it up, they will see things like a chocolate cyst.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it really does look like that. I have videos where it's showing this dark blood and it looks like chocolate. So if you have this large cyst, the recommendation is removing the cyst. And all of these options, I would say more than 90% of these surgeries can be done laparoscopic.
Yes.
That is with what you call keyhole surgery, put in a camera and you can do the surgery like that.
Okay. All right. Great. And one thing that I want to touch on, we talked about how contraceptives were the management for endometriosis. Now, can endometriosis affect fertility? And if so, what are the options for patients who are trying to conceive?
Good question. So the bulk of my patients who get referred for endometriosis to me are because they need some sort of surgical intervention, or their fertility is affected.
Mm-hmm.
So your fertility in these patients is affected because endometriosis, as we explained before, these endometrial cells go into the tummy, especially on the pelvic area, and they cause the pelvis to be very congested. They cause things to be stuck together. Now, the pelvis has a lot of important structures that come together in a small, narrow space.
Mm-hmm.
The bladder, the bowel, the ureter, and then the womb's right in the middle of all that, and the womb has its the tubes that is essential for somebody getting pregnant.
Yes.
So when you have endometrial tissue present on this tubules, on the fallopian tubes and around the uterus, it causes everything to be stuck together. And the problem is the tubes can be kinked, and it could that can lead to patients not getting pregnant. It can cause things like the bowel to get stuck in between the opening of the tube and the ovary. All of that contributes to infertility, and now you require surgical intervention. So how it affects fertility? One, it affects fertility by blocking the tubes. Mm-hmm. It can. We now know that pregnancy does, endometriosis does increase your risk of miscarriage as
yes.
well, and that wasn't known before. Mm-hmm. We know that endometriosis increases your risk of placenta previa. That's why you have a low-lying placenta. Mm-hmm. It does increase your risk of, you know, having bleeding during your pregnancy. You know, that these are new things that we've discovered recently, and this can all, again, medicine is something evolving, things can change in the future. But this is how endometriosis affect pregnancy and fertility. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if someone has a large ovary and with a chocolate cyst, they're not ovulating properly, you need to have that removed, and basically that's causing compression in the pelvic there, in the pelvis. And another way in which it affects fertility, and it's just simply, you know, if you think about the whole situation, if a woman is having painful intercourse
mm-hmm.
and she's having pain all the time, she's not going to want to be
yes.
trying to get pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
That in itself. So if you treat somebody's symptoms and alleviate it and explain to her the condition, that in itself improves things,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they start to understand, well, you know, what the condition is about.
It's like a mental...
Correct, yeah.
With the mental block from it.
Yeah, because mm-hmm. sometimes you have all this pain and discomfort and a patient does not want to try.
Yes.
Because she's having so much pain during intercourse, during the whole process, and she just, you know, and then by and large, cause stresses out, she doesn't want to try, she does, and increase your chance of infertility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But of course, I mean, these patients that are trying to conceive, we're not going to put them on contraceptives.
Correct.
So what are the options for these patients suffering with endometriosis trying to conceive?
Right. So some of these patients, they have bad endo or a lot of lesions in the tummy.
Yes.
So these are the patients who may opt for surgical
yes.
management up front.
Mm-hmm.
So we do laparoscopic surgery. We resect some of these endometriosis lesions. We free up the tubes. We do something called the term is lap and dye. So that's basically you put some dye into the womb to make sure the tubes are clear.
Mm-hmm.
Then you start them on fertility treatment right after.
Okay.
Now, the downside to starting on fertility treatment, you have to remember you're now stimulating the ovaries.
Mm-hmm.
If I have a patient on fertility treatment too long and they have endo, you're pretty sure the endo is going to act back up.
Yes.
So is a game between you're stimulating this woman to try and get pregnant while you're also stimulating the endometriosis lesion. So you have to kind of sometimes take a pause after a few months, go back in some treatment, come off it. So it's sort of that tug of war. You're trying to get pregnant, and then you're putting a pause on the treatment.
Yes, exactly. So we talked about how, you know, the mental blockage can, you know, take away from a patient trying to get pregnant. So how does endometriosis actually impact a woman's life physically, emotionally, mentally? How will it impact, you know, your patient's life? What have you seen and experienced in your clinic?
Right. So I always explain to my juniors and even to the anesthetist who works with me for surgery that endometriosis, or women with endometriosis, they perceive pain very different. I can have a patient who has very little endometriosis lesions. I could do the smallest procedure on her. She will have more pain than a patient I did cancer surgery on.
Oh, that's
and that's just because of how they react to pain. Endometriosis is all nerve-related as well. So you find that it is very difficult, and I've had this numerous times, where it's very difficult to control pain in these patients. And we all have to understand that they perceive pain differently, because someone with endo, you might say, well, why are they making all this trouble over some pain? And the next person might say, well, I had worse done to me and I didn't have that much pain. We have to understand it's very different for that patient. And there's a psychological component. I have patients who have endo and they have more anxiety. generally than other types of patients. So it's a whole entire picture where you have to look at the overall thing and manage all of these things. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to manage these patients in the perioperative, meaning before surgery, yes, during surgery, after. I frequently give these patients sometimes something to relax them before surgery, mm-hmm, because they're very anxious. Afterwards, I have to use more painkillers, and we put them on generous painkillers after surgery, so they can, and we taper it down, so they have a smoother recovery, they have an overall better experience.
Exactly.
And this counseling part of it, when you explain that to them, and especially explain that to the patient's partners, mm-hmm, it makes a big difference. The partners then understand, oh, okay, you know what, this is not just,
yes,
painful period. This, yes, is something entirely different.
Because pain can be physical as well as mental and affect you emotionally, etc. So this was a question that I received when we spoke about endometriosis last from one of our callers. Of course, a specialist will be, you know, more equipped to answer it properly. Are there any linkages between endometriosis and PCOS?
Not particularly. Mm-hmm. So it's two different conditions, and a lot of times I have patients who come to me with irregular periods. They have painful periods. And when I explain to them polycystic ovarian syndrome, irregular periods is a feature of this.
Mm-hmm.
People with endo tend to have regular periods, but it's painful and,
yes,
heavy. So if I have a patient with a combination of both, you'd frequently find they have irregular periods. Some, they'd say, doc, they have pain. Usually it's a combination of both. Mm-hmm. And it's not, from the research now anyway, it's not related.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So that's what I found as well. Like, there's no actual linkages, but they can coexist.
Yes, definitely.
In a patient.
And it's very difficult as well, because both of them contribute to infertility.
Mm-hmm.
PCOS causes infertility with someone not ovulating,
mm-hmm,
whereas in endometriosis they're ovulating, but they can have a tubal issue where the tubes are blocked, or a problem with actually egg implanting, or, you know, different issues, mm-hmm, with the endo. So and when they coexist, you now have to manage each.
Wow. Yes.
Yeah.
So we talked about, you know, the chocolate cyst being a complication of endometriosis. Are there any other complications that, you know, you encounter in your practice with patients with endometriosis?
Sure. So with endometriosis, you can have this chocolate cyst, you can have the adenomyosis, which really leads to an enlarged womb. And as we mentioned, it's complication. I have to also mention, that's the whole point of, some patients ask, well, doc, why do I need treatment now when we know they have endo? Why do I need treatment now if I don't have any of these things? And the answer is to prevent these things from happening. Because when they happen, you now need surgery. So you can have a chocolate cyst, you can have adenomyosis where your womb gets very large and you can have painful heavy periods. You can then have endometriosis stuck onto the bowel. I've recently had a patient who had to have bowel surgery, mm-hmm, because the endometriosis invaded into the bowel, and she used to have regular bleeding from the back passage, and she had to have a bowel resection. So we remove part of the bowel and join it back up. And remember, there is no cure, and I repeat that, there is no cure for endometriosis.
Mm-hmm.
It is all about managing the symptoms,
mm-hmm,
and patients have to be clear on that. So when they have this major surgery, you go on treatment after to be able to manage it like how you would manage a chronic disease.
Yes.
Like someone with diabetes, someone with high blood pressure, you put them on medication to control the disease so that they don't develop these rare complications, these serious complications.
Yes.
Other patients I've had a patient come to me because she has ascites. That's why I have fluid in the tummy. I published a paper on this where young women having this fluid in the tummy, they're having an elevated cancer marker.
Mm-hmm.
They think they get referred because there's a suspicion of cancer. And you realize that this is because of endometriosis. They want to have fertility sparing surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have their womb removed, but they have treatment for it, like laparoscopy, what we're talking about, and removing endometriosis lesions, put them on treatment after so it does not recur.
Mm-hmm.
And is the important part when I operate on anyone with endometriosis, I tell them, this is just part of a treatment. This is not the entire treatment. You have to go on medication after to control it so you don't have to get surgery again.
Mm-hmm. And I know you mentioned that the endometrial tissue can be found anywhere in the body, and you said that somebody had it in their breast tissue, etc. And I know this is very rare, a very rare complication, but what if it ends up in the lungs?
Right. Mm-hmm. So I have two patients with lung endometriosis. Mm-hmm. The lung endometriosis part of it is treated by a thoracic surgeon. Mm-hmm. And I've had patients referred from the thoracic surgeon saying, well, they've had to remove endometriosis from somebody's lung. Mm-hmm. But again, they are also aware that this is not the end. They send them now to me for counseling and further treatment where they can now be put on treatment long term so that doesn't flare back up. Mm-hmm. Because this patient actually presented with a spontaneous pneumothorax. That's where you have the air between the cavity of the lung and the lung. So they had that removed, they had that repaired, and they go on long-term treatment.
Okay. And we spoke about the medical management, the surgical management, but are there any dietary and lifestyle changes that patients with endometriosis need to undertake when they are diagnosed with endometriosis so that maybe their symptoms can be alleviated?
Right. So to be honest, that's probably the most common question patients ask and it's the most difficult to answer because we, as doctors, we train on all the scientific medical information. Mm-hmm. Now, the answer to that question is this. We know, and going back to basics, endometriosis acts up when you have high amounts of estrogen, because as I said, it's a condition that affects women in their fertility years. So now let's take foods, for example. From research, foods high in estrogen mm-hmm. will now affect endometriosis and cause a flare-up. Soya products. Now, if you have, and sometimes alcohol can increase your estrogen, the amount of estrogen in your body. Now, when I say alcohol, drinking one glass of wine, one beer is not going to cause that. So I don't want anybody quoting me and saying, Dr. Mal said, you know, they have endo, they can't drink any alcohol. Yeah. But I would say chronic alcohol use is mm-hmm. a problem. Now, let's take another feature of endometriosis being bowel symptoms. Mm-hmm. A lot of time, this is confused by irritable bowel syndrome. So I would then say any food that can exacerbate irritable bowel syndrome is not good for endo because mm-hmm. if you take foods high in oligosaccharides, monosaccharides, disaccharides, all those kind of conditions, preservatives, that can affect your bowel. As a result, if somebody has endo affecting their bowel, it will worsen the symptoms. Gluten, for example, there is an association, but again, this research is needed in this, and I'll highlight that. This is just anecdotal evidence from knowing the science behind it. If you take foods with gluten in it, it will affect somebody who has irritable bowel syndrome, and as a result, cause worsening of endo. Mm-hmm. Or worsening of symptoms of endo. So it's all about managing your estrogen levels, managing the kind of foods that will worsen bowel symptoms in order to make you feel better. Mm-hmm. Foods high in inflammatory which will cause increased inflammation in your body, that will also help. And again, this is anecdotal evidence, and there's no, you know, trials that was done on these things, but it's just thinking about what these foods have in it and then as a result what they can do.
And of course, so going on to base now.
All right, we need to take a little break and then we'll come back. Okay. Yes. All right, thank you very much. That's well. Of course you're listening, folks, to the Lunchtime Doctor. Folks, of course you're listening to the Lunchtime Doctor, Dr. Brittany Dean, and a special guest, Lean Into a Healthier Life with the GNC Total Lean, where actual science meets tasty flavors to make your wellness journey fun, delicious, and way more convenient. GNC Total Lean is a complete brand of weight management supplements, Total Lean meal replacements, and snacks. Not only can the high-quality products help you on your weight management journey, but they're also great solutions for living an overall healthier lifestyle. Available at GNC stores, supermarkets, and pharmacies nationwide. Visit at GNCTT on Instagram and more information. GNC, live well. Also, LSA Healthcare Services Limited is a commercial hygiene service provider with 20 years experience in the industry. LSA's goal is to change the culture of hygiene by educating their clients about hygiene solutions for all spaces. Hygiene is essential for all organizations' staff and the customers' well-being. It is business committed to high standards of hygiene. Check them out for the last or the latest innovations in hands-free sanitary bins, hand washing solutions, odor control systems, hand towel and jumbo toilet paper dispensers, sanitary dispensers, also janitorial cleaning and fogging sanitations. Right? Contact LSA Healthcare at 675-3466 for a free assessment. Visit their website at lsahealthcare.com, and social media pages on Facebook, IG, and LinkedIn. LSA Healthcare Services Limited, your partner in hygiene solutions. We now return back to the Lunchtime Doctor, of course, as we commemorate Endometriosis Month.
Okay, thank you, Bez. And of course, we have Dr. Bahal here with us. And we're just going to continue on our talk. We were talking about foods affecting endometriosis, but we were having a small conversation off the air about exercise and endometriosis, because, you know, us women, during our period times, we tend to shy away from going to the gym, you know, because of the pain from the periods. But people with endometriosis, they will get very painful periods. How can exercise help alleviate some of their symptoms?
So the long and short of it, exercise on the whole, I would always say that that's the one most powerful prevention tool or prevention advice for any condition, and it goes the same for endometriosis. Now, if you want a sort of look at the medical, the scientific basis behind it, remember we were talking about estrogen being a problem with endometriosis. Now, fatty cells, a lot of estrogen.
Yes.
And if you exercise and you have less fatty tissue, less estrogen, by and large, you will definitely have less endometriosis pain. And so generally, I would recommend this 100% that someone should adopt a healthy lifestyle that includes regular exercise.
Yes.
Now, if someone has pain during the period, to be honest, I'm not going to be the one to say, no, you have to exercise still during your period. No. But in general, someone should have a lifestyle that adopts, 4 days a week or however you can fit in your schedule of exercise.
Yes, I agree. And even, you know, during the period, you can do something not so strenuous, something maybe like yoga, something to help, you know, stretching the
tummy,
etc. And of course, we were also speaking about endometriosis and its linkage to PCOS, and we're saying that they're two separate conditions. However, are there any conditions or health conditions, for example, autoimmune or cancer, that can be linked to endometriosis?
So I always get asked when someone comes with a cyst and they have an elevated cancer marker, well, doc, do I have a cancer, or is endometriosis a risk of having a cancer? So there are certain cancers within gynecology that where endometriosis is a predisposing risk factor, and that's something called clear cell cancer. So it is not common. However, I've had patients who had clear cell cancer of what you call the abdominal wall or even of the ovary, and where their only risk factor was endometriosis. Now, I want to be clear, because you have endometriosis does not mean you're going to develop this type of cancer. It just means that this type of cancer is associated with it. Majority of patients with endo will not go on to develop this cancer, but there is an association. And endometriosis itself, similar to when I get asked about fibroids, it is not cancerous in itself. It is a benign condition, non-cancerous condition. Right, but there is an association.
We do have a call coming in there. If you mind taking a call, of course, 627-3223-625-2257. Hello, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Bees, and good afternoon to your doctor here. What is the best treatment presently for, like, say, 5% of AML leukemia? What's the best option that do I have? I will listen to you off the air.
Right. So what I would say is that you would have to go to your physician. Your physician will obviously do a proper history and examination of you and do proper investigations, but then you would be referred to a hematologist who will manage you appropriately. So we can't give you, you know, your best treatment on the air unless we diagnose you accurately. So you will need to get a proper, accurate diagnosis and be referred to a hematologist who will treat you appropriately. Right. So we'll continue our talk on endometriosis. And Doc, you were saying, you know, we're talking about autoimmune conditions or cancers associated with endometriosis.
Yeah, so basically there is an association, but endometriosis itself is not a cancerous condition, but there is an association with clear cell cancer.
All right. And any autoimmune conditions that associated with endometriosis or...
Currently, there isn't any hard evidence on it. I'm sure because of the nature of the disease, there will be an association with autoimmune diseases. However, I can't say, to be honest, if there is any hard evidence on that. Yeah.
So evidence is always ongoing.
Correct.
In the medical field.
Yes.
So maybe later on we'll find some linkages. But for now, there's nothing that we can say accurately.
Correct.
Now, I want to ask you a question. You know, in my research, there are stages of endometriosis, right?
Correct.
And what are these stages? And does treatment differ in these different stages?
Sure. So there's endometriosis is stage 1 to 4. And basically, in a nutshell, I'm not going to go through too much detail, but it is essentially using the stage to grade the severity of the endometriosis. And the treatment as and a guide treatment as well. Now, just going on the stage four patients with really bad endometriosis affecting the peritoneal cavity within the abdomen when people have large ovarian cysts. So when you have really bad endometriosis affecting these organs, it is stage four. But again, a lot of the treatment options, whether it be stage 1 to 4, it doesn't mean stage 4 is only surgery, and someone with stage 1 can't have surgery, because it does depend on the symptoms a patient have, because as we stated before, to diagnose it involves a type of surgery. And I had patients before where we're trying different things and they're still having this pain. We look in, and I'll give you an example. I had a patient who had really painful periods, we tried some of the treatment options, she was not getting relief. Went in with a camera and looked at in the tummy. She had a deposit, and mind you, this patient had an MRI as well before. All it picked up was a 1 centimeter lesion on the right side of the tummy. When we went in, there was endometriosis involving what you call the round ligament. What this means is there is a tiny ligament that goes into the abdominal cavity, and within this canal, endometriosis causes compression and causes severe debilitating pain. What we did, we opened up that area, removed that deposit, and her pain magically went away. And this woman was taken, we tried different medications and MRI, all it picked up was that, and we said, that's all, nothing else. Ultrasound was normal. So in that stage, in that situation, you can see how the combination of surgery then going on treatment after would have helped. I had another patient who had a small 0.5 centimeter deposit on a ligament behind the womb. It invaded into this ligament and was causing a severe pain during intercourse, and she said it just was not going away. We went in, we saw this, we ablated it, put her on treatment, and she was totally fine after. And these are cases where ultrasound, MRI, everything is more or less normal, can't figure out what's going on. Went in and we sorted that out.
Right. And of course, we were talking about the medical management. A lot of these are contraceptives, etc. There are patients who will be a little bit, you know, wary of using contraceptives because maybe they don't want to get pregnant now, but later on they want to get pregnant. Do you have any advice for these patients?
Right. So a lot of questions I get asked as well is, if I'm on this contraception for such a long time, will that cause me to not get pregnant in the future? And the short answer is no. To be honest, the sequelae or the side effects or the long-term issues from not being treated with endo is much more severe. For example, if you don't get treated for endo, and we know you have endo and you're not on treatment to control it, you could end up with infertility because your tubes are blocked. And then if your tubes are blocked permanently, the only way to get pregnant is in vitro fertilization. You can't get pregnant naturally. So, and back to your question, suppose someone's on the pill for 5 years. The answer is no, that does not increase your risk of not getting pregnant in the future. You can actually come off it and you can get pregnant the month after, 2 months after. So this myth that if you're on the pill for a few years, that's going to cause you to be infertile, the answer is no. There are some of the treatment options, for example, the Depo-Provera, that's the injection we mentioned, or sometimes the Mirena, that is associated with a delay in your return of having your period come back after a few months. But that does, delaying your period does not equate infertility. You could have a delay, but after 3 or 4 months, you can be trying and get pregnant just like any other woman. So the short answer is, with these treatment options, there isn't any long-lasting, permanent side effects of infertility.
Okay, all right. Mm. And, of course, endometriosis, like you're saying, painful periods, pain during sexual intercourse, this can actually be seen in other gynecological conditions as well. For example, if somebody has PID or pelvic inflammatory disease, it can be the same symptoms. So how do you differentiate between both?
So excellent. So that's why any patient that has these symptoms, the first thing, as you stated before when that gentleman called in, you have to take a history and examination. Mm-hmm. So I would take a history and examine. We look for signs and symptoms or sort of evidence where this is cyclical in nature. Mm-hmm. That coupled with an examination, to make sure there's no big masses there, nothing out of the norm, then we do an ultrasound, and we make sure that the ultrasound doesn't show fibroids or a collection of fluid or something else going on. So history, examination, we do a simple ultrasound initially, then we start doing other investigations to clue us in on it. Because yes, you can have fibroids, you can have a pelvic collection like PID, mm-hmm. you can have adenomyosis, you can have, you know, a simple ovarian cyst, something else that can cause pain.
Mm-hmm. All right, we do have a question there, and somebody's saying the doctor is an excellent gynecologist. I would just like to find out, what's the treatment for cysts in the ovaries?
So cysts in the ovaries is a general term. You have polycystic ovaries, you have large ovarian cysts that are not related to endometriosis. You have dermoid cysts, which are different type of cysts. So long and short of it, if you have very tiny ovarian cysts, like in polycystic ovaries, the answer is not surgery off the bat. I frequently get asked by patients, doc, I want surgery to remove these polycystic ovaries. That's not the answer. And we don't do surgery just for that purpose. However, if you have a cyst more than 5 centimeters that's causing symptoms, we then discuss whether or not surgery is right. I can have a patient with a 6 centimeter simple ovarian cyst with no symptoms. I might tell that patient, look, it's not causing any problem, looks simple, cancer markers are normal, let me see you in 3 months and repeat the scan. Mm-hmm. I can have another patient with a 5 centimeter dermoid cyst, that's a heavy type cyst, and she's having severe pain. Mm-hmm. And because it's twisting on itself,
yes,
that patient requires surgery.
Oh.
So it really depends on the size, location, the type of cyst.
Okay. And I'm sure a lot of listeners also would want to know about fibroids. Like when do you go to surgical intervention for fibroids?
Right. And again, any patient that comes to me with fibroids, we have different options now with the technology we have. And it depends on two things. Depends on the size and the location of the fibroid. I have a patient right now who has a 3 centimeter, that's very small, fibroid, but it's in her cavity, so in the lining of the womb. That's causing her blood count to drop to 4 and 5. She needs surgery, but the surgery we do for that, we put in a camera in the womb to remove it. There's no cut on the tummy, and that's called hysteroscopy. If that same fibroid was present outside the womb, that patient could have had that for years, have no problems. I will say, look, ignore that. We'll just monitor that every time you come for a visit yearly, and just to make sure it's not getting any bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and that's just dealing with a small fibroid in different locations. If someone has a big fibroid, we generally recommend surgical intervention, especially if they're causing symptoms of pain, heavy bleeding, if they're causing patient symptoms where they're pressing on their bladder and they have to use the bathroom really often. But by and large, fibroids are not cancerous, and we treat it based on the size and symptoms.
Okay, and it's the same thing for ovarian cysts.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
And as we were talking about cysts, I remember my time in when I spent in gynecology, and we operated on a teratoma.
Yes.
And
correct.
Yes, and patients are actually very, you know, they're stunned when they find out what is in a teratoma, and they see the hair, and they see exactly. It's very interesting. So I know we're coming to the end. Do you have any sort of advice for patients that may be suffering with endometriosis, or patients that may have the symptoms that we discussed here today?
So I would suggest that if you have symptoms that's really causing a problem where it's affecting your life, and affecting your life could be you having to take painkillers, maybe stay away from school or work, visit a gynecologist, have that discussion. on whether or not you need treatment, whether or not you need lifestyle changes, so that way you can actually prevent some of these serious conditions we mentioned, so that way you don't have to have surgery, you're not affected by infertility or even issues when you're pregnant. So it's all about preventative care, and as doctors, we treat conditions, but we all like and we always want our patients to engage in preventative care, so we don't have to reach the point where we need to treat them.
Exactly. Prevention is better than cure.
Correct.
I always say that. So thank you so much for enlightening us today about endometriosis, Dr. Bahal. And of course, we'll have you on for a lot more discussions when it comes to gynecology and, you know, oncology when it comes to gynecology as well. So thank you very much for enlightening us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
All right, folks, and of course, you've been listening to The Lunchtime Doctor. Of course, Dr. Brittany Dean is a special guest. Join us tomorrow again for another edition. Remember, LSA Healthcare, thank you very much. So check them out, and as well as our friends at GNC for all your vitamin and total lean meal deals. All right, Lunchtime Doctor, of course, heard at this time. We're live on Freedom 106.5 FM, Sangit 106.1, and Sky 99.5. Do enjoy the rest of your day.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.